Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ever been out shopping the morning after Christmas? It's kind of busy, actually. People sneaking out of work to spend those gift cards and snap up a few post-holiday bargains. Well, retailers are counting on those people. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Wednesday, the 26th of December. Now the shopping gets serious. You've probably heard the ho-hum retail sales numbers by now, up around 2.5% this holiday season by some estimates. So today, retailers are pulling out all the stops. They're slashing prices, offering free shipping. The Macy's here in downtown Los Angeles opened at 7 a.m., Joyce Laster snuck out of work to be there.
We saw it on the internet, on television, everywhere. I mean, you can't miss Macy's sale after Christmas sale.
I found Laster eyeing a pair of Coach shoes that would normally go for $158.
This caught my eye as I was passing by, so I said, 25% off. I wonder if they're going to be like another 25% off after New Year.
Laster wasn't the only one out shopping this week. Billionaire investor Warren Buffett announced a new purchase on Christmas Day. Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway agreed to buy 60% of the manufacturing giant Marmon Holdings. At $4.5 billion, it's the biggest deal Buffett's done outside the insurance business. Our New York bureau chief Jill Barchet has more.
The company Buffett is buying is owned by the Pritzker family of Chicago. The Pritzkers may be better known for their Hyatt hotel chain, but they also built Marmon into a conglomerate of 125 manufacturing and service companies. It's in everything from water treatment to transportation. Forbes magazine says Marmon is the 36th largest private company in the U.S. Ned Armstrong is an analyst of industrial companies at FBR Capital Markets.
They keep a pretty low profile, but I would say that they're well known within the markets they compete.
Armstrong says industrial companies like Marmon are doing pretty well. Both Asian countries and oil companies are expanding and ordering the kinds of building materials that Marmon makes.
I think to the degree that it's Berkshire Hathaway doing the buying, I think people will see that as validation that there's value in old, quote-unquote, Rust Belt type of companies.
Buffett may be better known for owning insurance companies like Geico, but manufacturing is not new to him. Bob Miles has written 3 books on Warren Buffett and his investing strategy. He says Buffett bought a similar diversified manufacturing company in Ohio 20 years ago. Buffett still owns it.
He's the ultimate capitalist, buying old economy industries. The average company he's purchased started in 1909.
But Miles says one of Buffett's biggest investment mistakes was an American manufacturing company, an old New England textile mill. Buffett ended up shutting it down. The mill's name, Berkshire Hathaway. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet for Marketplace.
In Indonesia today, rescue workers are racing to find survivors after some deadly mudslides in the western part of the country. The disaster came on the 3rd anniversary of the Southeast Asian tsunami. That catastrophe killed more than 230,000 people across the region. The tsunami also spurred an outpouring of support, $13 billion in aid from around the globe. Jeremy Hobson takes a look now at where all that money went.
When the wave crashed ashore, no place was devastated more than Aceh Province in Indonesia. Today, one agency responsible for relief there says 100,000 homes have been rebuilt and that relief work is 80% complete. Gerald Anderson, who directs tsunami recovery for the American Red Cross, says the billions of dollars in donations are getting where they need to go.
Livelihoods are returning. People are back to work. The markets are filled. It's just night and day.
Anderson acknowledges problems relief agencies faced early on with coordination and speed, but he says with time, those have been resolved. And he says in terms of corruption,
you're going to always have that when these kind of sums of money are involved. But I think the aid community at large is doing a pretty good job of tracking that.
Professor Leslie Lenkowski teaches philanthropic studies at Indiana University. He says life may be back to normal, but the real test of whether aid agencies used their money wisely won't be known for some time.
Was the rebuilding effort successful enough so that when some disaster, whether it's a tsunami or something else, strikes that region in the future, as it is almost certain to do, the damage and death will not be as great?
One other factor in the quick rebuild, beaches are magnets for tourist dollars. Now, I was in the hard-hit Thai resort of Phuket a week before the tsunami and again 2 years later. Any sign of destruction had been replaced by shiny new storefronts along the beach. The economy depended on it. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Wall Street got back on the job today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Those of you who've done a job search anytime recently might have had to take some sort of test. Get those number two pencils sharpened. According to the Boston Globe, some 2 million certification exams are taken in the IT profession alone every year. The Globe has been investigating a new industry that helps you cheat on those tests. Correspondent Kevin Barron joins us now. Kevin, what did you find?
There's a large online trade, a black market really, that traces to England and Sweden and Pakistan. In hundreds and hundreds of exam copies.
Let's say I'm applying for a job as a computer technician. All I have to do is slap down $30 and I get the answers to some test online?
Even less than that. On some websites, if you go online, you can download these from websites called testking.com or certificationking.com, microsoftcheats.com, all sorts of different names like that. And you get verbatim questions and answers as you'll see them when you get to the test.
And how do they get the answers?
Well, that's the ingenious part. A lot of test security experts had some interesting tales of people going in to photograph them using tiny cameras, button-sized cameras, lipstick cameras, scanners that look like pens. They'll even send in different groups of people who will go into an exam to memorize just a certain part at a time, come back out and recreate the entire exam. And they'll sell that as a study guide.
Is there money in this?
There is. The main website, testking.com, is estimated to be pulling in about $10 million a year in sales of exams.
What's the bottom line? I mean, are we facing a society where there are all these people out there doing jobs that they're not qualified for? Should we be worried about this?
Well, perhaps. A lot of these exams are not the only thing you need to get a job. But they are an often entry points to a profession. And the ultimate worry is what happens if an unqualified worker faces a situation that involves something like public safety.
Right, because some of these jobs are things like operating cranes. Lives could potentially be at risk.
Exactly. And many of them are required by federal and state governments, the crane operators being one. I think about 15 states require a certification exam given by one National Crane Operator Association. For an association like the crane operators, one leak of the test can mean the entire testing program has to be shut down and the test has to be rewritten, and that can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
One of the sites you talk about is called cheatsheets.com, and cheat is misspelled, but I mean, come on, how are they getting away with this? Isn't anyone out there investigating?
Well, in most cases, not really, the testing groups will tell us, especially the smaller associations that are specific to their own industries. They think that they're kind of out there on their own, and the only steps that they can take are to try to employ the most security that they can afford to stay one step ahead of cheaters. In some cases, different law enforcement groups have stepped in to help. Recently, there was a case of de-icers in Denver that were caught getting answers to a certification test there. And the FAA, and I believe Homeland Security is also investigating that now. But in most cases, groups say they feel like they're on their own.
All right. Kevin Barron writes for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin's story appears in today's edition of the Boston Globe. There's evidence that fewer Mexican migrants are entering the United States illegally these days. Some credit stepped-up border security. Then there's that decline in housing construction. Jobs have dried up. But illegal immigration is still a hot topic on the campaign trail. Commentator Robert Reich says the current debate over the issue misses the mark.
The biggest divide in America today isn't over social issues like abortion or gay marriage. It's not even over the war in Iraq or taxes. The biggest split is over immigration. Demagogues on the right and left are telling Americans our jobs are threatened, our social services overwhelmed, and our streets unsafe because of immigrants. Fear and prejudice are on the rise. According to a recent Pew survey, more than half of Hispanic adults in America today worry they or someone close to them could face deportation. Earlier this year, when Congress tried to enact a bipartisan bill that would better secure the borders and also try to regularize the plight of undocumented immigrants, giving them a path to become regular citizens, the bill was killed by these agents of fear and intolerance. Well, I have some news for these fearmongers. If they think this country or this economy can succeed in coming decades without tens of millions of additional immigrants, they're not thinking straight. The huge baby boom generation will be retiring, and there aren't nearly enough native-born Americans after them to keep this economy going, let alone keep money flowing into the boomers' Social Security and Medicare trust funds. The graying of America means we need this new wave of immigrants. Remember also that most of us born here are descended from immigrants. What we've learned is that people with a gumption to leave their country of birth and come to America are almost by definition ambitious. And the single most important asset of this economy and society is ambition. I'm not arguing that we throw our borders open. We need better border security. But to think immigrants are our enemies, or to believe that they're taking more out of the economy than they're putting in, is pure baloney. At this time of year especially, we need to remind ourselves of the tolerance and generosity that built this country by allowing our immigrant ancestors to become full-fledged Americans.
Robert Reich was Labor Secretary under President Clinton. His new book is called Supercapitalism. Send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. Now that the holidays are just about over, many of us are taking stock of the past year, balancing our checkbooks, making goals for 2008. For some, 2007 was a boondoggle. For others, a bonanza. Kind of depends on where you fell on the big market ripples. Here at Marketplace, we're taking a look at the peaks and valleys of those trends with folks who know them well, our reporters. Steve Tripoli covers a wide range of topics for us. One that he spent countless hours researching could be best described as risky business, otherwise known as the subprime mortgage industry. Only people kind of seem to forget about risk. Steve's here now to explain. Hey there.
Hi, Amy.
So how did underestimating risk get us into this whole mess?
Well, you know, Amy, you might say the better word for how our system blew it risk-wise is that we misallocated risk. That's really the original sin here. You see, there was no risk for many mortgage brokers and people who sold risky mortgage-backed securities. And that's because they got their profits, their big commissions, up front when the mortgage or security was first sold. So they had no incentive to worry about long-term costs if these mortgages and securities went bad. So in that case, why not just pump out super risky products, grab your profits, and let society handle the fallout? It's, you know, nice work if you can get it, especially in the days when banks held their own loans and their own risks, that was far less likely to happen.
Well, a lot of smart people are paid a lot of money to guard against these kinds of risks. Were they just asleep at the switch, or what happened?
Well, you're getting into the second way our system sort of misread the risk here, and that's through a failure of regulation. You know, now that this thing's blown up, it's interesting how many voices are saying we need tighter legal and regulatory controls. And we're just now starting to remember why we used to have those controls, not only for the protection of individual consumers, but to protect the whole economy. Because as we can see, it isn't just a bunch of folks with lousy mortgages who get hurt. The economic fallout really hits everyone. And this thing is rippling through everyone's home values now and through credit card debt and auto loans and student loans. And we're relearning that fiascos like this can hurt most everyone, so the regulation needs to be out front.
Well, if we go back again to these risk assessment experts, they were saying, right, that these mortgages and securities were safe. I mean, wasn't the whole point of bundling these subprime loans into securities that you spread the risk around? They're the experts. What do they miss?
Well, we missed something first, Amy, and that's that history tells us that these experts themselves can often be wrong, and further, that their fancy mathematical models for risk have been unreliable in the past. You know, just in the past decade, we've had a Russian debt crisis, an Asian debt crisis, and a crisis centered on the finance firm Long-Term Capital Management. And in each of those crises, fancy mathematical models blew up. So we forgot that the risk models themselves remain risky. And then we forgot one other risk. It's a built-in problem with these so-called experts who were calling these new finance instruments safe. Here's how researcher Paul Valor at the University of Minnesota characterized that problem when we spoke recently.
The experts, the people that we bring in to do some of this risk assessment, they're also private companies in a market looking for market share. So guess what? Maybe some of their risk assessments are going to be skewed from time to time based on their overall incentives to increase market share or to pursue some other goal.
That's a very polite way of saying those ratings agencies and others have conflicts of interest. You know, they get paid by those whose risk they rate, and Congress is looking into that setup.
So, Steve, what can we learn from this going forward?
Well, I just mentioned our lawmakers, and that's a place to start. They're rethinking the extent to which we let the regulation of risk slip. We've also learned that regulators and law enforcement people need to be on their toes, and those folks need the staffing and the will to rein in these risks that threaten the system. And we've also learned that risks like these mortgages and securities need to be priced right in the future. You know, a lot of people were saying these things were safe, and obviously they weren't. And I think we've learned that the penalties for those who abuse the system have to be priced right, too. By which I mean, if finance people are going to play with fire, they should be at real risk of losing something themselves if things blow up. You know, in far too many cases this time around, the people who got us into this mess walked away not only unpunished legally, but rewarded financially. And we need to think about that as a society.
All right, Steve Tripoli, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Amy, and Happy New Year, and maybe hopefully a less eventful new year for business reporters like us.
Absolutely.
Take care.
Tomorrow, we'll check in with our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, on how all these subprime shell games led to the infamous credit crunch. Coming up, ever wonder where companies hide their skeletons?
I love to look at the footnotes because that's where the really good nitty-gritty stuff is often buried.
But first, let's do the numbers. Retailers reported tepid holiday sales as stocks moved marginally higher today on Wall Street. The Dow was basically flat, up only 2 points to close at 13,551. The Nasdaq picked up 0.4% or 10 points to close at 2724. The S&P 500 inched up less than 0.1% or 1 point to end the day at 1497. We told you about those retail woes. Macy's felt the pinch today. Its stock was marked down almost 4%. Circuit City stores went on the fritz. Shares in the electronics retailer lost 6.2%. Amazon fared better. The online retailing giant clicked up 2% after reporting its best holiday season to date. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for November. In New York, the Conference Board releases its Consumer Confidence Index. As of last month's report, the index had been declining since summer. And Radio City Music Hall celebrates its 75th anniversary. More than 300 million showgoers have been through the Music Hall's doors since 1932. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. The evidence will be on the curb today, all those giant cardboard boxes that once held flat-screen TVs. They were one of the big sellers this holiday season. Which brings us to another story about another kind of box for another kind of television. We sent Mary Rose Abraham to a hotel in suburban Los Angeles to track the impact of a change in TV fashion.
In a guest room of the Warner Center Marriott, a large dark wood armoire holds center court. Its doors conceal a few small drawers, some shelves, and a 28-inch television. The armoire is the workhorse of the modern luxury hotel room, or it was, until the flat-screen TV came along.
Our travelers, typically our frequent business customers, are more and more in demand for upgraded technology, upgraded capabilities, upgraded entertainment.
That's Gordon Lester, manager of the Marriott in L.A.'s San Fernando Valley. The hotel is undergoing a $6 million renovation, and when it's finished, each room will include a new 32-inch flat-screen TV. And hundreds of armoires will find themselves out of a job. Industry analysts predict that more than 40,000 armoires will be on the market by next year, cast off by high-end hotels. At the Marriott, Lester says a few employees have asked for some of the old armoires, but most will be carted away to a place like this. Armoires line the floor at the large warehouse of Hotel Surplus Outlet. It's a furniture liquidation company also in the Valley. Company owner Don Fenning points out some of the new arrivals.
These are from the Mission Inn, two styles, the Venetian Hotel. This just came in from a boutique hotel in Santa Barbara. It's about 2.5 years old. It's Canadian-built armoire, really fine furniture.
Fenning says he has about 120 armoires on site and several hundred more in storage. Small hotels and motels are steady customers. But with so many of the big cabinets in stock, Fenning, like many other resellers, is slashing prices. A few years ago, he could get up to $1,000 for a used armoire in good condition. Now the average price is just $300, and he'd settle for less. Here's one of his ads.
They're currently overloaded with a nice selection of armoires in various styles, with clearance prices on armoires starting at less than $100 each.
That's a pretty good deal for a fairly new armoire. Fenning says hotel furniture usually has a life of 5 to 7 years, though many hotels are unloading their cabinets after just 2 years. But not with Fenning. Unless the pieces are standouts or come with the rest of the room's furniture, he's not interested.
You know, any project that's got several hundred armoires and an armoire alone without the case goods is a tough, tough project to sell these days.
And individual sellers are having the same problem. eBay has a glut of armoires on its site. And judging by holiday sales of flat-screen TVs, hundreds more armoires may be on their way out the door. I'm Mary Rose Abraham for Marketplace.
If there's one thing America loves, it's rich people misbehaving. Michelle Leader tracks these indiscretions by slogging through the fine print of companies' financial statements. She publishes the gems on her blog, footnoted.org. Leader's compiled a list of what she calls the big stinkers of the year. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
So what got you to start looking into these SEC filings?
I always knew there were all sorts of things that were buried deep in these filings, and companies are required to make these filings, and nobody was really paying attention to them on a regular basis, and I decided that that was going to be me.
So where do you find the dirt? I mean, how do you know what you're looking for?
Well, you want to look in a couple of different areas. I always like to look at the lawsuits and see what's disclosed there. And, you know, as my site's name might indicate, I love to look at the footnotes because that's where the really good nitty-gritty stuff is often buried. And sometimes I've seen even footnotes to footnotes to footnotes. So companies really go to extreme lengths to try to bury really the good stuff, and you just kind of have to ferret it out.
All right, so cue the fanfare. What did you discover this year? What are the big stinkers of 07?
Oh, all sorts of things. I mean, obviously Countrywide is in the news this year for the whole subprime crisis.
Right.
You know, earlier this year, they gave its new chief operating officer a $2.7 million signing bonus, a promotion bonus is actually what they called it.
I don't remember getting one of those before. What's that?
Have you ever been promoted in your job?
Oh, yes.
Okay, and you didn't get the promotion bonus?
I thought the promotion was the bonus.
Well, yeah. That's how it works for most of us, but in, you know, certain CEO circles, it doesn't exactly work that way.
Okay.
So this was a promotion bonus, and he was also given the keys, or actually given a membership at the Sherwood Oaks Golf Club, which on its website says that it's fit for presidents and kings.
All right, so what else is in the footnotes this year?
Well, you live here in the New York area.
I do.
And, you know, here, Morgan's Hotel Group had to hire a new CEO, and they're a pretty swanky hotel chain. And, you know, in addition to paying the new CEO $750,000 a year, they're willing to pay up to $30,000 a month for his apartment. Now, I don't know what your apartment costs, but I'm pretty sure it costs less than 30 grand a month.
And I can tell you Marketplace isn't paying my rent. Not directly,
exactly.
Anyway.
Exactly. And so you see sorts of deals like that where an executive will relocate. And, you know, it's fairly common for companies to cover the loss on an executive sale of their house. Now, on, you know, a couple of years ago on the upside, when, you know, someone paid $1.5 million for a house and it was then worth $2 million or $2.5 million, the executive got to keep the difference. So it's kind of like they, you know, win both ways. And it's just really interesting to see a lot of this stuff.
So do you have any other favorite perks you've come across?
My all-time favorite, you know, corporate jet usage is a big issue, and you're seeing a lot more disclosure on that. Quest Communications, which is a company that actually really got me interested in the first place in digging into SEC filings because I was an investor in Quest, disclosed earlier this year that the stepdaughter of their new CEO has access to the corporate jet. Now, I don't know how you went to high school. I grew up in Brooklyn, and I got on the city bus.
I drove my 76 Volkswagen Dasher, thank you very much.
I think I was on the B64, but don't hold me to that bus number. But this girl, I'm sure she's a great person. I don't mean to belittle her or anything like that, but she's getting access to Quest corporate jet to get back and forth to high school.
Now, how is that justified as an expense for this public company? Do they
security.
Have to justify it?
Security cost. So you can say that, you know, it's the security of the CEO and his family. But you have to wonder, is it really that big of an issue?
All right, Michelle Leader, I think we're both in the wrong line of work. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy.
Michelle Leader writes the blog footnoted.org. You can find a complete list of those big stinkers by going to our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, Baron Hilton, Paris's grandfather, announced he'll give most of his $2.3 billion fortune to charity, 97% to be exact. The money will be placed in a trust to benefit the Conrad N. Hilton Foundation. Conrad was Baron's father and founder of the Hilton Hotel Corporation. The foundation was established in 1944. The new money will boost the foundation's total value to $4.5 billion. No word on how that will cut into Paris's inheritance. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 2 points, closing basically flat. The Nasdaq added 10 points, 0.4%. And the S&P 500 bumped up 1 point, less than 0.1%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornone, Eric Johnson, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Next time on our program, it costs a lot to have a baby, especially when you can't do it on your own.
For some couples in the United States, surrogacy can reach up to $80,000.
I'm Amy Scott. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.